Shrink Wrap Radio number 784. Frances Mary O'Connor, PhD, on the grieving brain.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Loss of a loved one is something everyone experiences, and for as long as humans have existed, we've struggled when a loved one dies. Poets and playwrights have written about the dark cloak of grief, the deep yearning and devastating heartache of loss. But until now, we've had little scientific perspective on this universal experience. Today's guest, Mary Frances O'Connor, author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss, will bring us up to date. Mary Frances O'Connor, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Well, it's great to have you here. I'm particularly interested in the work that you've been doing. We're going to be discussing your work and your book, The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn and Love, How We Learn from Love and Loss.
Yeah.
And so you've spent a long career engaging in the scientific study of grief.
That's right. Yes. I'm slightly dismayed, but about 23, 4 years now.
Okay, well, that's good. That's definitely long enough for you to be an authority and for us to put some credence in what you have to say here.
Good.
From a scientific point of view. Now, the subtitle of your book is The Surprising Science of How We Learn and Love, How We Learn from Love and Loss. So what are the surprises that your subtitle is referring to?
Oh, that's a really good way to come at that. Some of the surprising things that we have found. And, you know, it's people are often surprised by how much we have discovered about grief and loss by studying it empirically, by studying it scientifically. So many people think about the five stages of loss, you know, which was what you wrote on your flashcards in Psych 101. But that's actually from 1969. And it turns out a lot has changed since then.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you. That's referring to the work by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
That's right, which was very revolutionary at the time.
Yeah.
We even talk with people about their experience of grief and loss.
Yeah. But
We've come a long way since then.
Yeah, did she get it all right, or did she get some things wrong?
You know, she was really trying to describe the experiences that people were having. And I think most people would recognize that, you know, often we have anger or often we have depression when we have experiences of losing someone that's very important to us. So I think that the what she got right in the sense that these were experiences and continue to be experiences people have. She never really intended it to be a linear set of stages that people would go through one after another.
Yeah, some people have taken it as a prescription, right?
Exactly.
This is how you should behave. And if
that's
you're
right.
not in this stage, you're in denial or something.
That's right. Exactly. When do I hit the anger stage? Because apparently I'm not done grieving since I haven't had anger. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not. We know now from empirical research, some by Holland and Niemeyer, some other by Holly Prigerson, that it doesn't actually happen in in discrete stages like that. That over time, people do tend to experience more acceptance, and they tend to experience less yearning, but that the feelings really, you know, vary day to day, honestly. So we don't think about it as a stage model anymore.
Yeah, maybe we've already addressed this in the stage question, but I was thinking there must be myths around death and dying, grieving and loss.
Yeah.
What are the myths that come to mind? Maybe start to get the trash out of the way.
Right. I think that's a big one. I think another one is this idea that you need to somehow forget the person. You know, my experience of doing clinical interviews as part of my research with people who are grieving the death of, you know, a spouse they've been married to for 40 years or the death of a child, it is seeming that people carry that loss with them through time. And you can even imagine how when we bond with someone, that changes parts of our brain. That, you know, from animal studies, we know that changes how the proteins get folded, you know, around our genes and so forth. And that's a change that is going to be with you. That's not going to go away. And so I think we need to consider the fact that people are carrying the absence with them, as well as restoring a life while carrying that absence that's meaningful for them.
Yeah. Okay. You distinguish between grief and grieving. And before I get to that question, there's another thing I wanted to ask you about.
Sure.
Because I think you're talking about a specific kind of grief. And maybe we should just make that clear at the outset here.
Well, most of my research has focused on the death of a loved one. And specifically for myself, often I am studying people who have experienced the death of a spouse. So husband or wife or longtime partner in one way or another. But certainly in general, there's research done on the death of a child. Death of a good friend can impact us a lot. And so I'm usually talking about a death, but of course we know that grief is not only experienced when there's a death, right? So we do experience grief over divorce, say, for example, or loss of a job. And I think the element that is similar about those is that, you know, these losses are actually a part of ourself. So people, you know, when they lose a spouse, they'll say, I feel like part of me has been cut off, you know, that lost a piece of myself. And I think from the brain's perspective, that may not be a bad description, that there are neurons that encode the self and neurons that encode the other. And then there are neurons that sort of encode both. And so this idea of how we operate, how we function in the world is necessarily including this other person. Even the word parent or the word spouse implies another person, right?
Yeah, you know, you're putting me in mind of phantom limb pain. I don't know if this is too far a reach or not.
Yeah, I don't think it's too far a reach. I would say that has not been empirically proven yet in the case of grief. But there are suggestions in terms of the way we encode things that I think it might not be. It's definitely a good analogy, and it is possible that we'll discover more evidence for that as we do more research.
Yeah.
I was just going to say the reason I think, too, that something like loss of a job then feels like grief as well, is that is also a part of how we function in the world, isn't it?
Sure.
Right? Like that is our identity.
You're
so
right.
When you stopped being a professor, that's a big shift, isn't it? In sort of how you operate in the world. And so I think that loss of a piece of ourself, of how we function in the world is often when we experience grief, regardless of what we lost.
Yeah. For me, it wasn't as traumatic as as one might have thought it would be, even as I'm, because I had two other things going. Yes. One was the podcasting, and I also had a market research consulting business going on the side, which I recently had to close down. But having those two things, it really helped to minimize the loss, the feeling of loss, plus the awareness that I really was finished.
Yes, right.
I was really finished with being a professor.
That's right. And, you know, people do often experience relief even when the loss is of a person.
Yeah.
And then they often feel a lot of guilt because they feel relief. But, you know, that is also one of the surprising parts of grieving, that we have all sorts of feelings we weren't necessarily expecting.
Yeah. I was shocked by how easily I let go of that job because I was reflecting on it. It had not been long before that I was surveying the campus and realized that I've got these keys in my pocket and I can go just about anywhere on this campus I can get in. And I had this grandiose feeling.
Yeah.
This is my university. This is my university. I can come and go as I please.
Yeah.
So that just, that grandiosity, that strong sense of attachment left very quickly.
That's so interesting. And, you know, I think something that sometimes surprises people is that acceptance can come very early, even when it's the death of a person. And, you know, if the death was in sort of the natural order of things, you lose a grandparent, for example. And sometimes people feel like, this person was important to me. Why am I not grieving? And I would say that you are having grief. You are living in the world now with the memory of this person, carrying them with you. But it doesn't have to look the same for everyone. Not everyone breaks down and cries all the time. Mm-hmm. Other people do, and that's okay too, but it looks a lot of different ways. So acceptance can come early, and maybe that's part of what you were experiencing.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Now, you distinguish between grief and grieving.
Yeah.
And so take us through that.
Yeah, I think it can be very helpful in distinguishing sort of a finer point that may help people when they're thinking about it. It also helps us a lot when we're thinking about the research.
Okay.
What are we really studying here?
Yeah.
So I think of grief as being that, you know, sort of ferocity of a wave that just knocks you off your feet and suddenly you're, you know, dissolved in tears, or you're just completely flooded with memories of being with the person. And I think of that as grief, a sort of that momentary emotional, cognitive sort of experience. And grieving, natural in the word itself, is the natural adaptation. So it suggests there's change over time, right? Grieving means that something is changing over time. And we don't know, you know, I'm an expert on grief, but each person is an expert on their own grief. So I can't tell you exactly what will change for people over time. But I can tell you that even the experience, so let's say, for example, it's been 20 years since you lost your husband, say, and suddenly you find his wallet as you're cleaning out a drawer, and you may very well be knocked over by a wave just as ferocious as the day he died, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that moment, that's totally typical. That's grief. That's the natural response when we're reminded of great loss. But it will probably be a different experience, even if you feel like, I don't want to be feeling this way, I can't believe this is happening to me, you will probably also feel like, this is familiar, right?
Yeah.
I've been here before. And that's sort of the grieving, that the way you relate to it changes over time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the grief is like the impact, which make that emotional impact, and grieving is more of a process. One of the themes that runs through the book that really impresses me is how permissive you are in terms of validating people's individual experiences. You really assert, hey, there's no pattern here. There's no should.
Yeah.
Each of us is a unique individual. And each of us will have a unique experience.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are burdened by a sense of should.
Yeah. How they should react in this instance. Yes. And I think we also, you know, we get a lot of messages from society about what we should be feeling, how long we should be feeling something, or how much we should show it or not show it, or from our friends and family. Sometimes we even get messages about what we should be feeling. And, you know, the reality is those feelings emerge. There's no, you know, we can decide what to do with them. So we can decide how to move forward in the midst of grief. But there's not really a should of how you should be reacting. And yeah. I think that our own discomfort with grief can lead us to want to sort of put it in a box, you know, and say, this is how it's going to work.
Yeah. I'm thinking that there is a big cultural component that, in this society, in this individualistic society that we live in, we kind of have this notion, well, you're an individual and you're allowed your individual experience. Yeah. But if you grow up in a different culture, there might be, and I don't know if you ever saw the movie Zorba the Greek, but there's a very dramatic, a woman dies and in this sort of very primitive old Greek town. All the grievers are dressed in black for a long, long time. Yeah. And there's this very dramatic scene where people swoop in, and I don't know if this was characteristic of Greek culture or not, and starts grabbing the dead person's stuff.
Yeah.
And so in other societies, in fact, there may be shoulds. There may be very delineated shoulds, but in our society, the Western society, we have both the, I'm just thinking out loud here, we have both the freedom that individualism allows us and also the loss of a frame, the loss of agreed upon rituals and somewhat shoulds.
Yeah, we have different subcultures. And while it is, you know, as a widow, I don't have to wear black for a year. I don't have to never marry again. And those are good freedoms. At the same time, in that moment of utter confusion, it can be nice to have a script of what to do, right?
Yeah.
And to feel connected, I think, to ancestors, right, who have gone before you. Well, they went through this, or I remember my grandmother doing this, or as some way to remain sort of connected in a moment when you feel utterly disconnected. I think this has been one of the difficulties with pandemic grief, is that so many of our rituals have had to change because we can't be together in the same way.
Yeah, I was going to come to the pandemic towards the end, so I may revisit that.
Yeah.
You refrain from giving advice about grieving, and it's part of, I guess, you know, why is that, I wanted to ask.
Yeah. I think that when grief is very new, especially, it's like the emotion volume got turned up, and I think everything feels wrong. You know, the whole world is wrong because this isn't how it's supposed to be, and it can make it quite challenging, I think, to connect with people, even with people who really want to be supportive and really want to be kind, if they haven't had grief themselves. Or, as you pointed out, if their grief was very different, right? Because grief varies a lot. Often I think the messages that bereaved people receive are around these shoulds, or people want to share their own grief, right? Like it suddenly gives them an opening to talk about the experience they've had. Under certain circumstances, in certain relationships, that can be a very bonding thing to share about. Oh, this is what you're saying, and I can relate to that, and this is what's happened to me, or this is how I handled something. In the right setting, that can be the right conversation to have. But often, especially early on, people just need to be able to talk and be listened to and have you be there for them and not try to cheer them up. The point is to be with them, not to make them happy.
Yeah, yeah. So, given that you refrain from giving advice, what is the potential value of your book to someone who has shared the loss of a loved one, suffered the loss of a loved one?
Yeah.
That's
From the
That feels like a little bit of a rough question, but
No, not at
yeah.
all. I don't think
Okay.
so.
Okay.
And I think I tried very often to explain to, editors and publishers and so forth.
Yeah.
It's not really, it's not a self-help book, but what people read it tell me is by understanding how the brain is processing this, and by understanding some of the theories of how we make sense of the world in the face of loss, I'm able to apply that information to my own life, and it helps me make more sense of it. So it's not that I'm giving advice because I can't tell the individual reader, this is what this should mean for you, but I can give them a window into a whole world of information about how the brain is a prediction machine, and the brain takes a long time to update its predictions,
Yeah.
longer usually than just finding out the person has died. And so we persist in believing they will come back, even though that feels crazy even to ourselves, and
Yeah.
yet really sort of have that feeling. Well, there's probably a reason, a neurobiological reason that we have that feeling. And I think people applying that then to themselves, if it applies to them, can feel very comforting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And so keep bringing in the neurobiology as appropriate, because I think that really is a lot of what your research career has been about and what the book is about, to better understand the brain and the brain body matrix that
That's
we
right.
live in. Yeah.
Even the brain mind body matrix, right?
Yeah, right.
Right.
Your book emphasizes learning, and that was kind of unexpected. Like, wait, what's learning got to do with, hey, somebody's died and I'm upset? Where does learning come in?
Right. I think part of this came directly out of an interpretation of the research findings that I've had, which is that we know now that the reward process is a lot of how we build a bond. So all the neurobiology of your brain, once you have your one and only, right? All the neurobiology of your brain is really harnessed to try and make you go back to them and spend time with them and see them and cuddle up with them at night. And, so all that dopamine and oxytocin is really motivating us to spend time with our loved ones. And in fact, it is a biological need to have attachment figures in our life. And so once the person is gone, we have to figure out not only we have to wrap our head around, no, they're really gone. And what does that mean? I'm not going to retire and travel with this person. That's been the plan for decades, So not only do they have to sort of plan, how am I going to understand what my life looks like without this person? But there's also just the learning process of what is it like now to be in the world with this new knowledge, with this real intimacy of knowledge that people don't live forever, and that we don't always know when people are going to leave us or when we're going to be gone. That is some deep knowledge that really requires, that takes a long time to work in. And I think the learning process of what to do with that information can take a long time. But that reward process is trying to help us in the brain. So if we stay tuned in, if we're present in the moment around what's going on around us, we can get better at understanding, okay, now what do I find rewarding? What do I find enjoyable? Even if it's only a little bit enjoyable, maybe I should keep trying to do that. Or if you're not finding anything at all rewarding or enjoyable, maybe I should try some new things. This is later in the process, in the grieving process. But I think thinking of it as learning, because we've been doing learning, since we were born, but since we went to kindergarten, I think it can make it feel more familiar.
Yeah. So we need to not just, you know, this important person died.
Yeah.
But I'm still here.
Yeah.
And I have to somehow not only accept it, but learn how to reattach to life.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's really well put.
Oh.
Yeah.
I have some other questions here that were kind of provided by the publisher, and I like to make up as many of my own as I can, but
sure.
these may be a little bit redundant of things we've already been talking about. Why is it so hard to understand that a loved one has died and is gone forever?
Yeah, this is a really, I may have said it this way before, but to say it a little more clearly, the brain is really the organ that tries to predict the world for us, doesn't it? Like that's its main function in some ways, is to help us navigate as well as, you know, we can predict what might happen next. Within that, if you think about it this way, you know, if you've woken up next to someone every day for years and years and years, and you wake up one morning and that person isn't next to you in the bed, it isn't actually a really good prediction to assume that they're never going to be back again, right? From the perspective of the brain, that's actually not what's happening. It takes a long time and a lot of experiences for us to accept that they're not coming back again, because the way we understand human beings and relationships is that they're there, they're permanent, they're not going anywhere. And so there's some real conflict in that information that people are getting. The belief on the one hand, they will always be here. And then the knowledge, you know, according to their eyes and ears, and that the person is not there, and you've been to their memorial, and, you know, you saw them in the hospital. And so that information kind of conflicts and takes the brain a while to figure out how to make sense of that.
You know, this might relate to what you're saying, is I have some friends and colleagues who have died, and I find myself reluctant to erase them from my phone book.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah, I'm curious if you have a sense of why.
Well, it just feels like it would be, I suppose it's a way of keeping their memory alive a bit. And it feels a little bit like it would be like killing them or making them unimportant.
Yes, yes. I think a lot of people struggle with this. What do I do now? And the truth of the matter is, you know, this sounds a little funny, but from the time that you're a little kid and when mom leaves the room, you come to understand, but mom will come back again, right? From that moment, we have what in psychology we might call a working model. You have sort of an avatar in your head, right? A virtual mom, right? Yeah. And you can refer to mom even when she's not present in the room. We do this with everyone, right? So we have sort of a map in our head of all the people in our life. And then, of course, we're also interacting with the actual people in our life. And so that map gets updated. Oh, they're older now, or oh, they had a baby or whatever. But the person in our head doesn't go away when the person in the world dies. And we can, in many ways, have a continuing bond with that person. So I can imagine the feeling of, I can't erase that from my address book because I'm still in contact with them, at least, you know, internally.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that in some forms of psychotherapy, one is encouraged to dialogue with that person, or
that's
to journal, to dialogue with them in the form of a written journal.
Yeah, even letters.
Or letters. And that's a way of doing some of the learning that you're talking about,
that's
of reprocessing.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you know, people do this more than they admit, I would say. So we did a research project in my lab. A graduate student of mine had people keep a daily diary, not a diary that you're talking about, but rather tell me about your day and tell me if you had thoughts or you felt you were speaking with, right, or in contact with their widowed people. So were you in contact with your spouse? And the vast majority of people have some way in which, you know, a woman described to me, I was having a conversation with my son. I was trying to explain something very difficult that was going on. And she said, I felt like, you know, my husband was in there, right? Telling me what to say. Right? Yeah. That's a really strong connection because you know that person so well, and they're so deeply encoded in your mind that you can actually draw on them as you have conversations, for example.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going back to the therapy situation where my rejecting, punitive father has died. But unfortunately, the imprint of that is still in my brain.
Absolutely.
And he lives in my brain.
That's right.
And so,
and he continues to be punitive from inside your brain.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so somehow, if I can work it out through imagination, dialogue, whatever, some forgiveness from that part of my brain.
That's right. We talk about for people who have unfinished business, right? Who never got to say goodbye or who never got to tell them how hard the relationship was for them, who never got to ask forgiveness or give forgiveness. In those situations, it can actually be helpful, especially, I would say, especially under the care of a clinician, but not necessarily. It can be very helpful to say goodbye in a letter, you know, that's written directly to the person, or to ask forgiveness directly to the person, because it then you have the memory of having done that in your mind, in your brain, and that continues to inform your ongoing life.
Yeah. Now, do I recall correctly that you've not only been a researcher, but also a therapist?
I was trained as a clinical psychologist, and my early work was very much doing therapy and through my internship. I haven't seen people in private practice in a very long time, but because I see so many people in interviews, it kind of scratches that itch for me. I get a chance to really connect with people where they're at in their grief. And sometimes I'm able to, you know, provide some resources even in the moment, although those are not ongoing therapy relationships.
Yeah. Another question is why grief causes so many emotions, sadness, anger, blame, guilt, and yearning?
Yeah. People are often very shocked by how intense the emotions are, and such unexpected emotions. People who are grieving often cry a lot. Not all of them, but, you know, my graduate students, when they start doing interviews, will say, wow, this person really cried a lot. And I'll say, yeah, they're grieving. They're going to do that. And then over time, they come to recognize, oh, that's actually the natural response, is that they cry a lot.
Yeah.
You know, in society, we're not used to really bearing with each other while we cry a lot.
Right.
So this can come as a bit of a shock. But there are other emotions as well, just like you said. And often there is even anger at the person themselves. Right? Even anger at the deceased person. How could you have left me? And if we think about that attachment belief I was describing, that they're always going to be there in the world, on some level, they have left you. And that feels completely unfair.
Yeah.
If they're really sort of still there somewhere, then they've left you. Almost like ghosting, you know, they've left you now and you're alone. And that seems terribly mean. And so you can feel really intense anger with the person, which then surprises people often a lot. I know this isn't logical to feel angry at them for dying, but I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, in myself, I think there are times when I feel I have regret about, talk about getting closure. I have regret about things, positive things, not anger, but positive things that I perhaps didn't say.
Yes.
Love that I felt that I didn't really fully express.
Yeah. I hear that as well. And, you know, I've even, in my extended family, we had the death of someone young recently. And what I hear from some of the, especially the young men actually in the family, is I need to say I love you to my living loved ones because I didn't say it. And now I regret it. Yeah. And it has made me, this is part of the learning, right? It has made me realize how important it is that we do that. And it's changed how I am in the world. So I can understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about your own experience with grief and grieving the death of your mother.
Yeah.
And maybe you can share some of that with us here, and particularly in terms of your research, I guess I'm wondering, did that add a dimension to your research on the one hand, and on the other, did your research give you a dimension of going through it?
But
maybe you were quite young. I'm trying to remember how old you were.
I was about 26, so I was in my second year of graduate school. So, young, old, some people lose their mothers younger. Mine was not, so my mother had breast cancer and then metastatic disease for about 13 years. And I think what it enabled for me was that I came to realize I could sort of go there, that I could really talk with people about death, and I could talk with people about loss and grief. And it enabled me to have these conversations that were research, and it enabled me to, not avoid the topic in my own mind, and therefore able to see patterns. And I think the maybe more psychological motivation was that my mother suffered from depression through much of her life, and my desire always to help her feel better, to be somehow able to make her feel not so lonely and depressed and so forth, really led to this desire for me to feel that way for people in general. And so it sort of sounds backward. It wasn't so much about studying my own grief so much as trying to find a way to help other people understand their own suffering, maybe in a new way, in the hope that it would help them in the way that I always wished I could help my mom.
Yeah. That definitely makes sense. I'm wondering if there's you make a distinction between grief and complicated grief.
Yeah.
What are you getting at there?
Yeah. So in the 1990s, people have been writing about grief, well, basically since there were people and writing, but psychiatrists and clinicians, started writing more about grief in the 20th century. And, each person sort of took their own view in many ways. And in the 1980s and 1990s, a group of researchers and clinicians came together and said, if we could come up with some sort of symptom, some criteria, then when we're doing research studies, we would know if we're talking about the same thing when we're talking about grief, or are we talking about the same people, or are these people who have different issues around grieving? And so a set of criteria were developed and were researched then over, a decade or more. And just this year, they have decided to add prolonged grief disorder to the DSM-5-TR, which is the revised DSM-5.
I haven't kept up with my DSMs.
I know, right? So there's, been a long period of study between coming together to develop a set of criteria and then to sort of name a disorder. But in the middle period, while we were all doing the research, it was primarily called complicated grief. So we've changed the name a little bit, but the general phenomena is the same. And that is that there are people who just get off the natural trajectory of learning and adapting. So I sometimes like to think about it in terms of complications with a broken bone. So when you break a bone, you're not actually doing anything to knit the bone back together, right? It is often very important to support the bone through a cast or something, but it's a natural process, right? It's going to happen. And you can always tell, even on an x-ray, you know, decades later, this bone was broken and knit back together. But sometimes there are complications that occur. So there's a second break to the bone, right? A second injury, or you get an infection in the area that's trying to heal. And these are moments when it can be useful to intervene, right, to actually get the person back on the healing trajectory. And so I think of complicated grief that way. There are experiences or ways of thinking or interactions that end up getting people off the trajectory, so to speak. And there are treatments that have been developed, more importantly to my mind, psychotherapies that are very specific to getting in and helping with those skills and are very effective, enable people, even who've had complicated grief for 10 years, to find a way to restore a more meaningful life. So that doesn't mean they don't have grief anymore, but it means that they're able to find a way to live with that and to also have, you know, real meaning and real depth to their life as well.
So the way I'm imagining it from what you've said is that in the grieving process, mm-hmm. Some people get stuck and the process is not proceeding.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, one example could be because of the intense suffering that comes with grief, often people really avoid situations that remind them of the person they've lost. They avoid conversations. They avoid, you know, they'll go a mile out of their way to work so they don't have to go by the hospital where their wife died. Ways of sort of avoiding and putting out of their mind that this has happened. And it turns out, you know, avoidance doesn't help with learning very much. So as painful as the thing is that you're trying to avoid, it is often the thing that enables us to learn how to live with it by being exposed to it. And so avoidance is one of those, you know, situations we get into in our mind. Sometimes it's not even avoiding something external, but avoiding it in our mind. And often we don't even realize that we're avoiding. And so through a course of, you know, targeted psychotherapy, we can actually find out if there's avoidance and then teach new skills and in a supportive way, enable them to engage again. And often this helps get them back on, you know, sort of a back on track, I'll say.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the brain, I'm also wondering now about PTSD and if there might be any similarities between the two.
It's such a good question. And I think there are, you can have prolonged grief disorder, you can have PTSD, and of course you can have comorbid depression and anxiety. You can have comorbid prolonged grief disorder and PTSD, especially often if the death event itself was very traumatic, like a violent death or a very unexpected death. These can sort of lead to a combination of experiences that the person is having. And this kind of exposure, which is, you know, a form of treatment that we do with PTSD, that can be very helpful in helping with avoidance in grieving as well. Whether they have different neurobiological signatures, let's say, I don't think we know that yet. I think we're still just a little too early in the process of the research to really know the answer to that. But we do know that People, this is work by Noam Schneck at Columbia, that people who are avoiding more tend to actually have more sort of intrusive thoughts. And you can see the patterning of that in a neuroimaging scan, actually.
Yeah, that's in the Freudian language, the difference between, suppression, that conscious desire to push things into the unconscious. But I think clinically we know that it's going to squirt out some other way.
It may, yes.
Yeah,
what's often complicated for people, I think, or what's confusing sometimes is people will think, I'm not having a lot of feelings of grief. Does that mean I'm suppressing? And so I just like to sort of help people make a distinction. If it's not squirting out in some other part of your life, you're probably not suppressing. You're probably just having acceptance, maybe earlier than you expected to.
Yeah. That's a good distinction to make.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the pandemic earlier, and we talked about different kinds of that your research has focused on a certain kind of grief.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of a different kind of grief that's going on right now.
Yeah.
With the pandemic and with the situation in the world today, will the earth continue, or will human beings continue? These are open questions now. Will democracy continue? And so a person can experience a lot of grief around that.
Absolutely. We think of those as, expectations we have in the world, and in times of uncertainty, we start to question.
Yeah. Do you have any reflections about, I'm thinking there may be a large social outcome of some sort from all of this pain and grief that so much of us are going through.
Yeah.
Do you have any speculations about that in terms of either how to deal with it or what's going to happen, either the upside or the downside?
Sure. I think we can actually learn a lot from studies of grieving to understand what's happening. So, when we lose a loved one under normal circumstances, when we lose a spouse or a child, it's like the rug got ripped out from under you, and nothing that you do day to day, from the laundry to the taxes to, going to Christmas dinner, nothing is the way it was before. And that takes an incredible amount of, computing power in the back of your head. It's always running, and you can't even concentrate on what you're doing because your brain is trying to figure out, whether you should say his name or not, So I think the similarity here is, suddenly, if you're going to meet a friend for coffee, you have to find out, have they been exposed? Have I been exposed? Do they wear masks? Are they vaccinated? Should I tell them that? There's now this litany of things that we have to think about with each individual event. We used to just have habit, right? You just woke up, went to work, went to the meeting, and nobody batted an eye. Suddenly, there is a loss of the way we've always done things. And what grieving people find is everything takes a little longer because you got to process it. And there's a lot of emotions, right? People in the country are pretty angry right now.
Yes.
When we have loss, we're often very angry, just like we've been talking about. When we have loss, we're often very sad. We're often very pessimistic. And I think that's part of possibly what's going on right now, that people are really having to reconsider the fundamental things in their life. Do I really like going to work, or should I work from home? Why are my children in this school? What are they learning? These are not questions we ordinarily have to tackle. And suddenly, this pandemic and these other crises have really put us into thinking about the fundamentals and feeling some grief about how to operate in the world. My hope is that, like when people learn, like when people adapt, it's not that any of that is going to go away, but my hope is that we learn how to be with uncertainty, how we have compassionate responses to other people who are suffering the way that we are. So over time, I'm hopeful that that grieving process can lead to some acceptance. Our world is different than it was before. And some learning about what's important as we go forward. What do you bother to spend your energy on could look different. And that could be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You talked about how our brain is busy trying to recompute.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's got anything to do with this, with the different sense of time that many of us experience of not being sure. Time feels both sort of paradoxically to be moving fast and to be moving incredibly slow.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, our sense of time is not something we have a lot of neurobiological evidence about, but we know that it is very much encoded in the brain and that we actually use time in a similar way to the way we use distance. And, you know, so the here and now is together, you know, encoded. And so if all of your patterns have changed of where you go and how you interact, we're suddenly, you know, we're sort of relating back to some before time. People even describe it as the before times. And then you're not quite sure what to do with the length of time since then, how to put that into context. I think you're right. And I think grieving people experience the same thing, where you know, it seems like yesterday that the person died, and also they feel like they've been in this forever.
Yeah. Wow. Well, is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you would like to say?
You know, I thought when you were talking about the pandemic, there was a line of questions I thought you might end up asking. So I'll just say, you know, I think we also forget sometimes that bereavement is a health disparity. So, you know, 65% of all children that experienced a death of a caregiver were racial and ethnic minorities. And, you know, so American Indian, Alaska Native kids were 4.5 times more likely to lose a caregiver, and Black children were 2.5 more times likely. So I think it's important when we're thinking about grief to remember it doesn't affect us all the same way. Not all of us have the same support as we're going through it. And I just think that's, as we're thinking about it broadly, I think that's an important thing to remember.
Yeah, that's an important thing to bring in.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've done it then. Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much, David. This was a great talk.
I really enjoyed my conversation with today's guest, Mary Frances O'Connor, author of The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. I especially like the fact that her expertise is grounded in nearly 30 years of scientific research on her topic, as well as the fact that she is trained as a clinical psychologist and has conducted therapy in that role. And of course, her obvious enthusiasm makes for a great interview. On top of this, she also has her own experience at age 26 of her mother's death. About that time, she writes, "My mother's oncologist described her as his first miracle. She lived another 13 years, a reprieve from the universe for her two teenage daughters, my older sister and me. But in this world, I was my mother's emotional tonic, her mood regulator." Close quote. She points out that having gone through the loss of an important figure in her own life has made her a better listener when sitting with others going through the process. One of the biggest themes that runs throughout her book and her work is her recognition that the grieving process is unique for each individual. Her own research and that of others debunks the idea that there are certain stages of grief that each person must pass through in a certain order and within a certain period of time. I felt very good about some of the questions and personal observations that came to me in the moment. For example, I raised the point that the unique grieving path many of us in the U.S. experience is very likely a reflection of our national character that emphasizes individuality. Other cultures, including subcultures here in the U.S., may have prescribed stages, rituals, and expectations. As a scientist, she's committed to understanding grief and grieving in terms of the brain. She is motivated by scientific curiosity. She writes, and I quote, "I always wanted to understand the why rather than just the what. Why does grief hurt so much? Why does the death, the permanent absence of this person with whom you are bonded, result in such devastating feelings and lead to behavior and beliefs that are inexplicable even to you? I felt certain that part of the answer could be found in the brain, the seat of our thoughts and feelings, motivations and behaviors. If we could look at it from the perspective of what the brain is doing during grief, perhaps we could find the how, and that would help us understand the why." In another passage, she reveals her fascination with the tools of neurobiology. Quote, "I went to Northwestern University just outside Chicago and was eager to escape rural life, to be going to college in a city where more people worked in one block than lived in my hometown. The first time I ever came across a mention of functional neuroimaging was a few sentences in my Introduction to Neuroscience textbook in the early 1990s. Functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, was brand new technology available to only a handful of researchers around the world. I was absolutely intrigued, although I did not imagine that I would ever have access to such a machine. I was excited about the possibility that scientists could see into the black box of the brain." Close quote. While Mary Frances is reluctant to give advice in this book, as well as in person, she does feel her book will serve an important role for readers who may have already experienced a major relationship loss by giving them an understanding of how brain function inevitably shapes the grieving process and eventual acceptance. And of course, these losses are something we all will have to deal with and learn from sooner or later. On that basis, I strongly recommend The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss by Mary Frances O'Connor, PhD.
Hi, Dr. Dave. Tim here. I'm a psychologist from the Gold Coast, Australia. I was thinking recently it was about time I got off my butt and contributed some money to your wonderful program. It's given me so many hours of pleasure and education, especially on the drives to work. And I think it's important to support your mighty efforts, Dr. Dave. So I'd urge everyone out there to donate, contribute some money to make sure your show, very fine show, Shrink Wrap Radio, is around for a very long time. Okay, see you later.
Thank you, Tim, there on the Gold Coast of Australia. I couldn't have said it better, mate. My family and I are now all COVID-free. Let this be a reminder to you all to mask up and keep physically distant. By the way, we all were double vaccinated and boosted. We did take a chance at being unmasked at a family Christmas dinner, and we suspect that's what did us in. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Thanks to today's guest, researcher and therapist, Mary Frances O'Connor, for discussing her work and her book, The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss. Next week, I'll be speaking with Veronica Gold, LMFT, and Eric Seinecht, PsyD, who are founders of the Polaris Insight Center. They are innovators in the rapidly expanding field of psychedelic therapy. Their group specializes in the ethical and compassionate clinical use of ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.